What questions should researchers be working on? Has development economics lost its way by focusing too much funding and effort on the micro? When development economists have results, how should they package those in a way that encourages take-up? And what types of institutions and organizations can help with that process of ensuring that the best evidence informs policy decisions? Welcome to Ideas in Development, a VoxDev podcast on economic policy and research. I'm Oliver Hanney, the managing editor here at VoxDev. And today we're going to cover all of those big questions and more, for which I'm really excited to be joined by Rachel Glenister, who is the president at the Center for Global Development and has a long career spanning both the research and policy sides of these debates within development. Rachel, welcome to Ideas in Development.
Great to be here.
So after the tumultuous start to 2025 in terms of aid funding, I hosted yourself and Stefan Durkon for a conversation about the future of foreign aid. And during that event, you outlined your proposal for a radical simplification of aid. Could you briefly summarize what that would look like?
Yeah, so this comes out of an observation that I and others who've worked in aid have had, which is that we're really spreading ourselves too thinly, both in terms of countries and in terms of different projects. So when I was at FCDO, we had, we had many countries that we worked in, and also within a country, many, many different projects. And we were kind of reinventing the wheel a lot of the time in setting up new projects. And instead, I think a better way of doing it is to focus a particular donor, particularly a bilateral donor, on a few key areas where they can gain real expertise. And I don't just mean, just focus on health. I mean, within health, focus on some specific areas that you think you have a comparative advantage on and where there's lots of evidence. So within education, a donor might focus on structural pedagogy, for example, as a tool to improve education, or you might focus on the ultra-poor graduation program. And that's, take the ultra-poor graduation program, that's going to look very different in different countries. You would encourage people or support people to go into different kinds of industries or different kinds of entrepreneurship suited to that country, but the underlying basic program would be similar. And I'm not saying do just one, but maybe six or seven that are your key areas of focus. But it's also about fewer countries. So fewer projects, fewer countries, and that allows you to build up expertise and not have to reinvent the wheel every time. And also encourages people to focus on the projects where there's a lot of evidence that they work at scale and are highly cost effective.
I think you wrote your original blog about radical simplification over a year ago now, and the event was also over a year ago. I was wondering if your views on this have evolved in the year since. Are you more or less convinced of this need for radical simplification right now?
Yeah, so I think I'm more convinced than I was last year. And part of that is due to the resonance that you see. We're all thinking about how to get aid to be more supported in rich countries. And I've just seen in the US in particular that Congress is much more supportive of areas where they really understand what USAID or what the State Department was doing prior to the cuts. So PEPFAR has a lot of support in Congress because, it's relatively simple to explain. It did a huge amount of good, and Congress can see this is what our money went for, and the public can see this is what our money went for. We can see how many lives were saved, and that's just very hard to do when you basically have an aid program that says, it's all very complicated and leave it to the experts. And if you do that, then it's kind of unsurprising that you lose support for aid.
I was wondering how structural transformation and economic growth fit into this, because ultimately, those are the best way of lifting people out of poverty at scale. Is there space for funding this more messy work on growth within the simplification framework that you've laid out?
Yeah, so let's look at the things that we think will lead to growth. And I think sometimes people have an idea that there's all these micro things that you can do, and then there's growth things. But that's not how I think the evidence suggests that growth works. You know, what are the things that we know are correlated with growth? And even, you know, we have even better evidence that they lead to higher productivity and therefore growth. And they are things like improved human capital, improved energy, I think is an important part of growth, and improved agricultural productivity. There's been some really important, interesting work recently that shows, you know, the kind of chain of structural transformation using variation in when we got improved seeds that work in different parts of the world, and then showing how that leads to better health, better education, that leads to demographic change. The demographic change helps lead to growth. So the idea that the things that I've talked about are not growth enhancing is a misreading of the evidence. Now, you know, things like energy, people do tend to put in the growth bucket. And I think there is lots of good evidence about energy. And again, that's one of the things that you could focus on as a bilateral, is supporting improved access to energy for firms, right? So there's a bit of a confusion here, but the thing that supports growth is access of firms to good, reliable, cheap energy. And that is something that we have evidence about, and I think people could focus on. But these other things are not, you know, not outside the growth orbit. They are key contributors to growth.
To follow up on that, I guess, do you think that that case has not been made well enough? Do you think that the ways in which the various programs or sectors that have been studied a lot and we have a good evidence base on, like some parts of education, do you think partly the problem in this debate is that there's not been enough work directly tying or linking that to kind of these bigger growth debates?
I think it is. Look, it's hard to do the kind of work that is well-identified causal work that looks at how do you get structural transformation. I mean, that's just a very hard problem to tackle. We used to run cross-country regressions to try and get at this, and that is the thing that the literature has moved away from, basically because they were not very good. I mean, you could run them and get very different answers if you, you know, tweaked the way you ran the regressions at just a small way. And so that was a very unproductive debate, I think. I mean, we learned something from it, but people moved on because we wanted to learn more. And I think you have seen these structural models that also incorporate some causal identification, like the Blades of Grass paper by Doug Gorlin and co-authors that I was mentioning earlier, and some, you know, important trade papers. So that move, I think, is very important and interesting. Those papers, they are hard to do because there aren't that many sort of random things that happen across many countries, and at the size that that you need to kind of pick up structural transformation. So it is hard to do that, but I think everyone is excited when one of those papers comes out. And to be frank, in most of the academic literature, there isn't a debate about should you do micro or macro. Like, people just want good work. And where the tension is that there is a hunger to be able to say, this one thing will make you Singapore, right? And yes, developing countries, low and middle income countries, would love it if somebody came and said, you need to do, you know, the sector you should be focusing on is X. And, you know, if you do that, then you can become Singapore in 10 years. Like, that's the thing that people would love. And the answer is there isn't. There isn't one thing. There isn't one sector. We can't predict it. And you can make a lot of money by going around saying that you can, but most people in the literature think that, you know, in the academic world, think that that's just, you know, giving false hope. And there's a subtler point, which I think is important to understand, which is that not everyone can become Singapore, right? There is, in a sense, there's sort of a slot for doing cheap manufacturing goods at any one time. And maybe that'll go away with AI, but it's not like every African country can move into cheap manufacturing goods at the same time, particularly when a huge country like China is occupying that space, right? We're all hoping China moves to more advanced things so that that slot opens up. But it's you can look at who gets the slot next, and there might be characteristics of who gets the slot next. That does not mean that everyone who did that thing would take that slot, because there is only a certain size slot in the world economy. Not everyone can be doing the same thing. So I think that's completely missed in a lot of this discussion.
Yeah, and this kind of ties directly into the debate that was on Twitter recently, kind of about these micro versus macro topics. If you're not on Twitter, or you have a more normal Twitter feed than I do, then you might have missed this. But there was a lot of debate between economists and development people, essentially trying to figure out what questions development economists should be focusing on. And obviously, as with most debates on Twitter, it wasn't particularly useful, and there weren't exactly answers to these questions. We've covered some of those topics already in those answers, but one thing that you've mentioned online since the debate is that essentially we shouldn't treat macro and micro development economics as competing approaches, and that they're not substitutes, but they're complements to one another. I guess I definitely agree with that. But given that there is kind of a fixed amount of funding available, a fixed number of spots in top journals, I guess this is where I do sympathize with the macro folks. Because I think even though we have learned loads from the careful causal identification work we've seen recently, I do think that has maybe been disproportionately favored in terms of funding and publication. So my question is, if you're looking back over the past, say, 20 years in development economics, would you have liked to see a discipline that didn't skew so far in the direction of that careful causal identification work?
I mentioned in that Twitter debate that I have sat on some of the selection committees for papers for, you know, top conferences like the NBR Summer Institute. And we're always looking for a balance, you know, just because it makes life more interesting if you have different kinds of papers and about different topics. And we're always looking for good macro papers in that, in those conferences. And we are seeing more of these structural papers. You know, development has moved a lot in that way. Often they're micro combined with a structural model. And sometimes they are now cross-country. As I say, a lot of these trade papers are coming up that are, that, you know, you could call macro in the sense that they're sort of looking at a bunch of different countries or innovation. I mean, Jacob Moscona has a lot of interesting papers that, again, cross-country, but they also use sort of more micro identification techniques. And I think those are the best papers, really, that sort of bring together a lot of the micro lessons and micro data, but sort of tell a big story. But I think those really build on all that detailed micro data. And I think there's, I don't actually think that development is out of line with, say, what happens in rich countries. Like, you tend to get more micro papers in rich countries because there's just more questions. I mean, what is macro? You know, inflation and growth and, you know, exchange rate policies and things. And partly we have, when I started in development, we had a lot of papers on inflation in Latin America, you know, hyperinflation, how do you solve hyperinflation? And that was a big part of my, you know, undergraduate exams was answering questions about that. Well, we just don't have very, we kind of solve that. Like, we know what it takes to get rid of hyperinflation. There isn't much hyperinflation in the world. Like, we've saw, you know, monetary policy in developing countries. There were big discussions when I was at the IMF and, you know, moving towards more market-based monetary policy setting. We've kind of solved that problem. So we've solved some of the macro problems in that way. Obviously, we'd like to see more growth. But that is what a lot of the macro papers were about. We don't have as many of those because we kind of solved it. Now, again, I think there is this hunger for papers that say, this is the answer to growth. And it's just, you know, this one thing, this is the sector that you should focus on. And that's just, you know, there won't be a lot of papers on that. There won't be maybe any papers on that, because it's just what we know from the evidence is there isn't one single answer. So I don't think there's a bias. I think, and also to some extent, academics have to go where the, you know, where it's possible to answer the question. I mean, we'd all like, you know, an answer to, you know, big scientific questions. But if we're not there yet, we can't, you know, we can't solve, you know, multiple sclerosis overnight because, you know, people are working on it, but they don't have a solution yet. So that I think you have to go where, to some extent, you have to go where you can answer the question. And we have answered a lot of macro questions, which is great.
And you've mentioned there that you have been seeing like a growth in these papers that kind of bridge the divide between the micro and macro. I mean, I'm based at CPR, so this is where I plug Doug Gollin and Joe Kobosky's STEG program, which is trying to fund exactly that type of work. I guess if we're thinking about how this more macro development agenda or set of kind of papers and ideas moves forward from here, I was wondering if you could kind of think through any lessons from seeing how the micro development ecosystem of research, researchers and organizations has kind of blossomed over the last 20 years. Are there any insights there for macro development in terms of the process of building up research institutions and communities that will be necessary to kind of do more of the type of research they're doing and also scale their influence?
Yeah, so I love the stuff that's coming out of the STEG program and, you know, have followed Doug's work for a long time. I think what's great about Doug in particular that I know his ways of working is he is doing these more big structural models, but he spends a lot of time making sure he really understands what's happening on the ground, and that informs what, you know, how he goes about trying to answer these questions that might span over many countries. And that, I think, is a big change in what happened in development. You know, when I started in those cross-country regressions, David McKenzie talks about this a lot. You know, he was sitting there running running regressions without spending time on the ground. And one of the big things that changed in development is with the move to more RCTs and more empirical causal papers was that that people spent a lot more time, you know, collecting data and being in the field. And that is the thing that generates ideas. So that is one lesson that I think is really important to learn from that experience is if you're going to write about and study, learn middle-income countries, spend time there because that's where you get your ideas from, of just talking to people. And, you know, I've been in a lot of qualitative interviews with farmers and adolescent girls and, you know, about marriage decisions. And you hear someone talking and it links to, you know, an economic model. And you suddenly realize what they're talking about is, you know, is part of an economic model. And you're like, okay, that's something that then I can test. And I think that's the story of a lot of people, that their best ideas came when they're in the field and talking to people. So I think that we mustn't lose that when we go for these sort of big picture ideas. So that's one. But I think also these communities that grew up around, you know, people, like a long time, I worked in Sierra Leone a long time, and I know kind of nearly all the researchers who've worked on Sierra Leone, and we've shared our ideas and we've shared our contacts and, you know, what are the pros and cons of different data sets. And so there's a lot of shared knowledge that gets passed on to people. And if you think, I mean, people used to criticize how many papers came out of Western Kenya, but that was because there was this kind of learning lab on the ground where, and a lot of local Kenyans got very skilled up in doing research. And so a PhD student could come into that community and start work immediately because there were a lot of skilled people on the ground they could work with and a lot of understanding of the context. And so building these communities, I think, is really important so that everyone stands on the shoulders of everyone before and don't have to reinvent the wheel.
And returning to some of the areas that have been mentioned so far where development economics has built up a significant evidence base, and then thinking about how that actually translates into policy decisions, I was wondering if you could discuss the role of evidence panels in creating these recommendations for policy, like the best buys lists that we've seen in education.
Yeah, so just a slight correction. Smart buys is what we now come on again. So this is an idea of saying, let's bring together a community of people who know about the evidence across different disciplines. So in the education panel, we have psychologists, economists, education specialists, and practitioners, all people who care, and, you know, we're thinking of bringing in some brain scientists who know about the evidence in their discipline. And then we do a rigorous systematic review of the research, but we don't just do a systematic review. We then bring it to all of those experts, ask them if there's things that have been missed, but mainly like hash out recommendations that is a consensus of recommendations across these disciplines, you know, qualitative and quantitative researchers we have on the panel too, from different regions of the world. And we found that to be very powerful, partly because you learn a lot. Like as an economist, I saw the evidence differently after many, many conversations with the psychologists and the early learning specialists, because I realized, you know, they were using different metrics than us and, you know, economist metrics weren't superior to their metrics. And so you learn a lot and you build this consensus. And it's also got a lot of judgment in because it's about recommendations to governments. So it's not just how many papers, but it's cost effectiveness and can this scale? Can a government scale this? Like, we don't want to recommend things based on, you know, a small pilots. We want to recommend things that governments can do at scale. And what's great about the panels is then you come out with these recommendations and they're not extremely prescriptive. They are, for example, you know, reduce the time to schooling really helps with attendance and enrollment. You could do that by building more schools. You could do that by, you know, giving girls bicycles. You could do that by having community schools. Like, there are a lot of different ways to do that, and which one makes sense depends on the context. But we are seeing this overall general pattern across many different contexts that this is really influential. And if you're in a context where enrollment and attendance are a problem. So come out with these recommendations that can be tailored to the context and really put cost effectiveness at the heart and scale at the heart. And then when you work in a country, everyone, all the advisors are saying the same things. So it's not like a government is hearing different recommendations from UNICEF or the World Bank and FCDO. Now, all those three are part of the convening group. I mean, the experts are independent experts. There's a convening group. So all those organizations are bought into the recommendations because they're a part of the process. And so that's very powerful, I found, on the ground to have this consensus. And it's a hard process to get that consensus. But once you've got it, it's very solid.
Outside of that kind of process of learning you've described and the recommendations, the smart buys that you put out there in the public, I was wondering, I mean, are these panels playing like a behind the scenes role? Are they a sounding board for policymakers or education ministers who have specific questions about their own policies and context?
The panels, which draw from people from, you know, all around the world, then those individual panel members play quite a role in their region, you know, talking about the evidence, talking about the recommendations, and working with governments. Now, they are not the main people having all of those conversations, right? So, but the bank and UNICEF and other researchers in the area working on these will also be having all these conversations. But what's nice is they all have a kind of agreed framework that those conversations are going off. So the What Works Hub on Education is kind of part of the secretariat for this group and, you know, has people embedded in countries and can follow up on the detail. But the panel itself can do some of that. But these are all, you know, very hardworking, busy people, and they will do their region, but they can't do every single government. So it's really then a network of institutions that sort of take it forward. But I really think the fact that they're all then saying all that network is sort of on the same page about what to recommend is really helpful.
Yeah, and you talked about the difficult process of reaching consensus, and I guess that part of that comes down to the tension between packaging evidence in a way that is very easy to understand and action for an education minister, but then also still trying to capture at least some of the nuance of the evidence base as it is currently. How do you think about that risk that these type of smart buy lists oversimplify what we know or are too sticky in people's minds if the evidence changes and there's some new, better kind of program that has been discovered by researchers?
Yeah, so we reevaluate every few years the list, and things have gone up. I don't think anything's gone down. We tend to, but it could if we, you know, find new evidence that suggests something isn't as effective as we thought. So that helps with the, you know, how do you cope with new evidence coming along? We're in the middle of redoing the education one at the moment. Then the nuance side of it, we're producing more detailed papers about individual smart buys and recommendations. So very excited that some experts in early childhood development are going to do a sort of a more detailed paper on how do you do that. So it's quite high up on our list. You know, a lot of people do early childhood development differently. And so what does the evidence suggest are the key elements for that? And so working with the real experts on the literature to kind of hash out what we think we know about that. And again, it's going to involve judgment in there. It's not a simply, you know, running a regression on this. The other thing is the nuance of what context a given recommendation is useful for. So I think that was really important in our recommendations. We have the recommendation and then the context. So for each recommendation, we say, these are things, this is the kind of context, not a list of countries, but, you know, if you have challenges in access or if, you know, like school meals, for example, is effective, but it's quite expensive. And a lot of us coming from Africa were quite, you know, we're worried about the expense and is that the highest priority thing that people should be doing? And, but then that was where it was great to have people from Latin America saying, well, you know, we can afford this. Like, and it does help. And that's where it makes sense. Now, I should say, you know, at CGD, there's a group trying to think about how to reduce the cost so that it is cost effective and it can be cost effective in certain situations in Africa, you know, where nutrition is really stopping kids from going to school. But where a lot of kids are already in school and then you do school meals, you kind of, you know, there's a, I mean, I hate to call it dead weight loss, but it's, you know, you're feeding a lot of kids who would have come to school. So that is an expense. So who would have come to school anyway. So that's an expense. So that's the kind of nuance that we put in the context. And it's not very long, the context section, but it's the key things that we think are relevant about that. And I think that's important. Now, the implementation of, you know, a lot is in the implementation in any program. And just, do you actually do the thing that you're saying you're going to do? Like, does the food get delivered? Are the teachers actually doing structural pedagogy or teaching at the right level? And that involves, you know, people on the ground working very closely and governments working effectively. And that's not where we get, that's not the role that the geek gets into. I have this outline for how you do evidence-based decision-making. And it has three boxes. And I kind of use it for pretty much any practical question. Right? The first is evidence on the need, right? And it's context-specific. So it's, what is the need in this area? And you can look at data from all, you know, from surveys, national surveys, qualitative work, and that helps you understand what is the problem that you're trying to fix in this country. The second box is generalized knowledge, which is things like, and that's the slot that the GEEP is trying to fill. It's saying, what do we know across the globe about how people respond? And then the last is implementation. How you implement is very context specific. So a few years ago, there was this huge argument about, you know, should you have general knowledge or context? And again, I said they're complements, but this is the framework. What piece of evidence are you interested in? Some of it has to be local, some of it has to be global, and the evidence panels are filling that middle block. The other blocks are very important, but that's not what the panels do.
And I was wondering if this kind of panel model is something that should expand even further. And I think particularly for me, what comes to mind is an area where their evidence base is very thin at the moment, but there is clearly a big need from policymakers for advice and a sounding board. So do you think something like this could work for the economic impacts of transformative AI in low and middle income countries where realistically there's not actually much evidence yet to make clear recommendations to policymakers? But because this is such a new and potentially highly impactful area, there is still the policy need, even if the evidence base isn't there yet.
Let me split that into two parts. Is there a need for more of these panels? Would they be useful in other areas? Absolutely, yes. We are working on a new one for skills for jobs with the World Bank. And so what's the space for a new panel on that? I would love to see one on nutrition. Why did we pick those areas? We picked them because there is enough evidence that you can come up with these kinds of recommendations, but they're not so well known. You know, like you could argue in health maybe that, you know, there's disease priorities initiative, which already does some of this work already, although it's, I think, now too long and complicated for governments to really understand. But there's a lot of work on health. So where is a lot of evidence, but it isn't yet kind of synthesized in a way that's right for governments. And then there's the question of AI and do governments need help on that? So the answer to that is yes, they do. And at the Center for Global Development, we have a fast-growing AI team, which is trying to tackle things like, you know, how to advise governments on which AI tools are useful. So I think there's absolutely a need for that. And but I don't think it's ready for a GEAP yet. You need something different. But one of the challenges in AI is that things are moving so fast that I think we don't get to the optimal with the standard kind of government procurement or the sort of approach that you can use in other sectors of saying, you know, wait till you've done RCTs and you know that this is the best teaching tool using AI, because by the time you've gone through all of that process, there'll be a better one on the market. So CGD has actually come up with an evaluation framework, which is meant to help funders or governments think about, and I'm not saying this is the last word, but people have found it helpful to say, what are the kinds of things that you should look for? And it's not, you know, the standard full evaluation kit of, you know, run a trial for 3 years and then choose. But it is asking some basic questions. And there are things we know, for example, on AI for education, that adaptive learning is a useful technique. Now, which is the best adaptive learning tool? We have to get into deeper and start saying, well, these are the kinds of things that you should be looking at. But for example, one of the big problems with AI learning tools in schools is that they're not used. Right? So that you don't need an RCT for that. You get that kind of feedback quite quickly as to how often they're used. That sounds obvious, but actually people weren't using that to evaluate AI tools, right? And a lot of them fail because the teachers aren't using them.
Picking up on some of the themes we've discussed so far, one term that I've been floating around recently is this idea of expert-based policymaking, which is something that Michelle Rao, who's also at CGD, and I kind of discussed as we were planning this series of podcasts on evidence. And I guess the panel model you describe kind of strikes me as confirmation of this reality of how evidence makes it into policy, that essentially we have this system in which people become experts, they earn their stripes, they do what's needed to climb the academic career ladder. And then if they choose to be and they want to be more involved, they can move into more advisory work with politicians. Do you think that's a fair characterization of how impactful careers in economics tend to evolve? And I guess, do you see these types of people who build their academic credibility and then start doing this advisory work when they're more senior as essentially the main node or the key way in which research and evidence actually makes it into the policy world?
So there certainly is that career path. And I think that's shaped a lot by the incentives within academia, that you don't get much reward for doing policy work before you get tenure. And I think that's a problem. And so because you get people waiting for them. Now, that's not entirely true, though, because if you want to do some of the kind of work that I've done, you often have to be working for government, with governments, to even get, you know, projects off the ground. You know, I've done a lot of work with co-author Kate Casey, who started off working for the World Bank and then working as an advisor within the government of Sierra Leone on evaluations, and kind of got to know everyone. And I remember thinking when I was writing her letter for her PhD, you know, I've seen her get data out of governments that nobody else could get, and that's going to stand her in good stead for doing great work in the future. And I did not put that in because that would have been seen as a negative on, you know, for recruiting her to get a PhD, which is ridiculous, right? She ends up persuading governments to, you know, political parties in Sierra Leone to randomize whether they hold primaries or not in given constituencies, right? Which makes for a brilliant paper. Entirely because of all of that work, working with policymakers, you know, for she knows everyone in senior levels in Sierra Leone, and they trust her because they've worked with her for so long. So she can persuade them to do things like that. So that does actually make a good academic career too. But, you know, that's not rewarded until much later in terms of the policy impact. So there is. It is rewarded if you get good papers out of it. So there are people who are building up those relationships, but they do take a long time, which is why I talked about those communities where PhD students can stand on other shoulders, because, you know, they're automatically introduced to the network that someone more senior has built up. So that's the academic incentives and why it works that way. But it's not the case that they're the only people who have influence. I mean, on our GEEP panel, we have Ben Piper, who did not do that model. I mean, he has a PhD in education, but he, you know, worked as a consultant and has worked on the continent. I mean, he's very influential across Africa because he's, again, he's been on the ground. He's worked with these people for many years, and now he's at Gates. But he knows the literature very well. We have Rukmini Banerjee, who comes from an NGO background, right? So there are other voices that do this. But it is, I think, unfortunately, a bit of a tight circle, and we need to think about how to expand the circle to more people, more pathways. And one of the things that, I mean, you asked about kind of the institution building that has happened in development. One of the good things is there have been all these institutions, and people now can make a career moving, you know, from JPL to CGD to BIPA to, you know, and there is a different career. Ideally, we also have that within governments, in and out of government. Like my career has gone from government to academia to government again. And I would like to see more of that happening.
For the final question, I wanted to get into a bit another factor that's crucial in this debate about evidence, which is who actually generates it. There's been some academic debate and a couple of papers kind of going back and forth about the poverty trap recently. And it made me think about a type of trap that I guess development economics finds itself in, which it continues to have this huge kind of representation and concentration problem in terms of the institutions which are most influential, most of which end up being in kind of based in, at least on the academic side, in the US and Europe. And they are the ones who receive a lot of the research funding and the kind of academic prestige from that research. In the short term, I've kind of heard this justified on the grounds of research quality. And the argument is essentially that researchers in institutions in the global South are not using cutting edge research methods to the same levels as researchers based in the US or Europe. So they're not generating the type of causal identification, if we're talking about micro, that is rigorous enough from the perspective of funders and paper reviewers in the global north. I was wondering, given the kind of fast changing funding landscape in development and the disruptions to research funding more broadly, particularly in the US, do you see this as a window to be more bold on fixing this failure of the discipline, with development funders instituting far stricter rules on development funding and publication, rather than kind of the types of adjusting around the edges approaches that we've seen so far, which I, in my mind, have kind of failed?
So I think it's important to, I've thought about this a lot over many years. I think it's important to understand what's the outcome that we care about. And there are different objectives here, right? Why do we care about where something is produced? So one is that you want research that is really understands the local context and doesn't make mistakes, and therefore is just better quality research because it's from people who have a deep understanding of the challenge. You know, you're answering the challenges that people actually want answered. You are taking into account factors that might be confounding your results that you don't understand. That is all about knowledge of the context. It's not about where you're based. So, you know, Isaac Mbeete or Daphne Tsori, who are two of the top African researchers, they are based in US universities because they do better work there and nobody should force them to work out of Africa, right? And also, you know, a lot of other people, Chris Ujiri, you know, spent huge amounts of time making sure he understood, you know, the context in Ghana and the challenges in Ghana and, you know, doing the detailed descriptive work to understand what are the issues. Okay, so that's, to do good quality work, you need, that's relevant to people, you need people who really understand the context. And that's very important, but it's not where you're based. It's how much time you spend on the ground and how well you know the institutions. Then there's, are you influencing, you know, are you sufficiently integrated into the local systems that your research has an impact? And again, that's not, that could be better if you're based there, but you've just got to trade off, you know, and sometimes it's not better if you're based there. And then there's, are you, but having people from the areas, they will bring a lot to those two aspects, but it's not the final, you know, you've got to trade, there's a trade-off there. And then there's, are you building institutions so that students in these countries can gain this expertise and be better at being in, you know, will go on to government and research and entrepreneurs, and that you do need to be on the, you know, on the ground there, right? You do want local researchers. But if you then ask the question, well, how do we build better institutions that, you know, that students get a better, you know, a lot of students get a lot of better training, then it's not, you know, then you go about that in a different way. So I think it's really important to divide the question. Like, what's the thing that helps people on the ground have a better life, right? That's the objective. It's not, can we tick off some box that, you know, X percent of researchers come from wherever. It's, do poor people in these countries have better lives? And that means better policy, better research, more research that asks the right questions, that's integrated into policy, and that they get a good chance of a good education at a tertiary level so that they can then go into policy and, you know, with an understanding of all of that. And I just tackle those separately. So that's my answer. It's also obviously because there are benefits to having people who know the institutions well do cutting edge research. You know, I've thought a lot about the steps that you need to get that. And we set up the MicroMasters at MIT to do that. One of the challenges is in economics is getting enough people with really good math skills, right? And so it's much deeper so two things, you know, things like Ledwanchakon's African School of Economics really helps, you know, is trying to solve that problem. And then the Wyss Fund is working on the problem that you have people who get trained from these countries, but they won't go back because the universities are paying such disastrously low wages that they can't live, literally. I mean, if you look at the Pakistan wages for academics, it's, you literally can't live on them. So it's only independently wealthy people who take those jobs. So they're saying, can we supplement the salaries of good people who go back? So just take the individual pieces and design things to solve them.
Rachel, thanks so much for your time. This has been Ideas in Development. We're available wherever you get your podcasts. Please leave us a 5-star rating or a thumbs up if you enjoyed today's episode. And as ever, all past episodes are available on the VoxDev website.